originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm Mike Pena, coming to you once again from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, wishing everyone across HRN Nation a very pleasant Wednesday afternoon. So many of you are listening live on Sirius 219 XM Channel 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or archived podcast, which are available on our HRN website at horseracingradio.net. Really happy to have you with me for the next hour. And as those of you who listen to this show week in and week out and have done that now for nearly seven consecutive years, you know that this is a show where sometimes we have the chance to visit with the more established trainers in the business, people like Todd Pletcher or Bob Baffert or Steve Asmussen. Other times, we have the chance to visit with an individual who is just getting started with their career. And that is the case once again here this evening as I get set to welcome in the 29-year-old native of New Jersey who began her training career a bit earlier than she anticipated. She has saddled only six starters to date in this extremely young career. But on September 2nd, in the second race at Monmouth Park, this happened.
They're a quarter of a mile from home. Candy Cane Lane still there. Optic Way a half length back in second. Another three back to Epic Dreamer in third. On the extreme outside, Wild Scat Blue is trying to make some late progress. A 16th pull, and it is Candy Cane Lane clinging to the lead. Optic Way trying to grind him down. Candy Cane Lane, Optic Way, Candy Cane Lane, or Optic Way, Candy Cane Lane. What a game effort on the front end. Optic Way right there for a close photo. Wildscat Blue, Epic Dreamer.
Well, Frank Miramati bringing them home. Candy Cane Lane, a gutsy effort to get the victory. The first career victory for our special guest here on Trainer Talk tonight. That is trainer Charlie Demodio, and she is kind enough to spend a little time with us here this evening. Charlie, first of all, you could hear somebody screaming in the background of that call. Was that you?
That was me, and it's so funny because a friend had commented, like, after watching the replay, they're like, you can hear you screaming, you know? I was like, really?
Well, you should be excited. That was a tremendous moment for you, as it always is when you saddle your first winner. Take me back to that moment. Let's start there. What was that day like for you?
Oh, my God. That day was like such a whirlwind of emotions because I knew this horse was sitting on a win. And then when the skies just opened up and started pouring, I was like, oh, okay, we definitely got it. And even the guy who was running the horse for me, he's like, oh, I should grab my rain gear. I was like, no, I'm checking the radar on the phone. I was like, no, it's going to be cleared up for our race. Don't worry about it. I was like, we got the rain for the horse, and then it's going to be gone for us, and we'll stay dry. And watching the race and him taking that lead honestly scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
I was like, what are you doing up there? You better not get tired.
That's great.
But yeah, I can't even personally stop watching the replay. I'm so proud of the horse because so many people from the old barn were telling me how lazy he is. Because if you look back at his other races, especially when he did break his maiden and he went for a second time for Sacco last year, Jacques really had to urge him into that win. And watching the horse really win that race, and even you see on the backstretch the first time Optic Way tries him, I even told Jerome, I was like, don't try and do anything. Let the horse run his race. He knows what he's doing. Wait until the stretch before you ever have to make a move. And I was nervous. I'm like, oh God, don't get worried about optic light. Don't get worried about it. And Candy took one look at him and just was like, nope, you're not doing this today. And I was so proud of the horse because he made that decision and he wanted that win. He wanted to be on the lead. And which is so funny because we're in a time in this country where people think we're forcing these horses to do it. And we're not. And if you watch a race like that, Candy made those decisions. He wanted to be up there. He wanted to win that race, and he went out there, and he did. And I'm more proud of the horse, honestly, than myself. I just consider myself really, really lucky that I have a horse like this fallen into my lot. It's just given to me in my hands. Like, oh, okay, thank you for this next horse.
Yeah, special moment.
Yeah, I can't get over how proud I am.
Special moment, and again, a gutsy effort by Candy Cane Lane to get that victory on September 2nd. Charlie DiModio, our special guest, that was her very first career win, if you missed me saying that at the top of the show. Charlie, I've always said that if you could take that feeling of watching your horse cross the finish line in front, whether you're an owner, whether you're a trainer, whether you're a breeder, whatever it might be, if you could take that feeling and you could bottle it, this would be the easiest sport in the world to market and to sell. So how do you describe it? What is that feeling like? What was that feeling like when Candy Cane Lane crossed the finish line?
It was a combination of like pride and disbelief and just euphoria and love, like real love, because this is my passion. Like, I didn't grow up in this. This is just something I kind of started doing because I always loved horses and I always wanted to work with horses. And this is the only part of any horses in any kind of industry, show horses, what, like standardbreds, whatever, that I could come into and learn and make money at the same time, because, you know, bills are always knocking at your door. And I just, yeah, I was filled with love for the horse. He gave me a win. And I don't know, it's so hard to describe that feeling because I can't even. I was just so happy for him. I was so proud of him. And that he gave that back to me as much as I gave to him. And Zoe always told me, listen to the horse, which is what I told Tom Lucci in the interview as well, because they do speak their own language. They speak with each other out in the wild. They speak each other in fields. They speak to you if you're willing to listen. You know, it's in their behaviors, the way they carry themselves, if they're biting you, not biting you, if they're eating a certain way, or even the way their stall is. You can tell by a horse's behavior or if they're not feeling good just by their stall, by their poop, by are they running around their stall too much and making a mess of it, or are they nice and relaxed and they keep their stall nice and clean. And Candy is definitely the type of horse that needed to be heard. I hear so much about him from before I had him and how he was such a monster and everyone was afraid of him because he would run off on riders. I remember last year when I was still working for Georgia Navarro, which is the first barn, and it were right by the three-quarter gap, and where my stalls were in that barn was right by the road, and all of a sudden I hear hoofprints hit the road, and I'm like, wow, that sounds like a loose horse. And it wasn't, because all of a sudden I hear the rider yelling, close the gates to the stable gate, because the horse just came flying down the gap. Just took the bit from the rider, was going.
Oh, no.
And when I was running Candy for his second start with me, it was August 2nd, that same rider was there, and he said, you remember when I got ran off? But that was Candy Cane. I was like, oh, my God. But he needed to be heard and not be feared. And that's basically what I did with him. I listened to him in the stall because he used to try and kill me even in the stall, slam me in the walls, this and that. And he used to run off with me at the farm as well. And then I learned, okay, you know what? If you're running off, you got all this energy, you clearly just need to burn it. So I let him burn it and get his mentality back. Because some of these horses, you know, they're like humans. Where you have like your little child in kindergarten who can't sit still. And he's just burning up with energy. You know, you need to entertain them more. You need to let them run around a little bit more. And that's just Candy Cane. You needed to let him burn his energy so you can actually get to know his real personality. And all he right. definitely burned his energy when he won that day.
Yeah, wait a minute now. I want to go back to something you just said. You said he needed to be heard and not be feared. And then you talked about him slamming you into the stall walls and everything. How are you not fearing that horse at that point when he's acting like that?
You just have to know how to stay ahead of the horse. Again, you have to read the horse. He always has tells. Once I got used to him trying to slam me in the wall, it's even just the slightest twitch of a muscle. You learn how to jump out of the way before he keeps coming. And then you learn how to stay so far ahead that you actually stop him from even doing it once you see that twitch of the muscle. Even like if they're going to strike, you could see they'll toss their head a certain way and they'll bring it up at an angle and toss it up, and they usually toss by the pole, not by like the mouth, and then they'll strike. So if you see that head toss, you stay ahead. Like if you have a shank on them, you get the pressure on the shank and keep them from actually throwing their leg at you and striking you. If you're willing to pay attention and understand their body language and stay ahead of the bad behaviors, you can actually put an end to the bad behaviors.
You know, Charlie, you don't sound like somebody who didn't grow up in the sport of thoroughbred racing. So let's go back to the beginning. How did this love affair with horses begin for Charlie D'Amato?
Well, actually, my adoptive parents brought me here as a child to the races. My father, he liked to gamble and bet, and you know, they always had family fun day, so a lot of times he came on Sunday. So I was one of the little kids getting their faces painted here. We had the balloon animals, and I would pick horses based on their names. So I probably would have picked Candy Cane Lane because I really liked the game Candyland as a child. I had $6 in my pocket. I put two across the board, and that's exactly how my father made me bet as a child. We always put two across the board just to, you know, appease me. And a lot of times they would come in with big money, and I'm like, see, you should have put more money down, Dad.
That's good. So what about your parents? Did they like your decision to get involved with thoroughbred racing like this and to become a trainer?
Actually, no.
Really?
No. And my parents actually haven't spoken to me in years because I developed a relationship with my birth mother, which made them unhappy. But when I was still talking to them when I started working on the backside with Joe Zoffi. That's how I met Zoffi, was because of my adopted father. And I used to be the trophy girl for group sales up in the winner's circle about 10 years ago. And in 2013, my father convinced Zoffi to take me on. And apparently someone told me, they remember this conversation, my father had said, you know, just entertain her. She doesn't belong on the backside. She doesn't belong working with horses, but she thinks she can do it. She wants to do it. So just take her back there, show her a few things, but make her life miserable. Make her hate it. And obviously that didn't work out the way he planned.
Yeah, you fell in love with it.
Yeah, I've always loved horses since I was a kid. I had a few experiences. I got to go to camp once for a week and learn to ride. My uncle had horses, so my parents let me go up there when I was 16 for 3 weeks, and I got to hang out with them. And I had just all these positive experiences with horses, which is why when they slam me in walls, I'm really not afraid of them. I'm like, they're not going to do anything. And they can kill you. They really can. But I think my lack of fear is both stupid but helps me at the same time.
When your parents are not on board with the concept, and when your father's telling Joseph that, hey, just make her hate this, does that make you want it even more?
Yes and no. I mean, that was so many years ago, and I only just found out about that like this year.
Yep.
So there's no point in really having a bitterness over that conversation. If I knew about that conversation back then, I would have been very angry. And I just would have still continued, doing what I wanted. Because at the end of the day, it's about my happiness, what I love. We come into this world alone, we die alone. So I'm going to please myself before I please others with what I do with my life. And I'm very glad I did, because, like I told Tom Lucci, I would have never been in that winner's circle with Candy Cane if I had listened to what my parents wanted me to do with my life.
Yeah, was there ever
a
time when
you'd probably be miserable?
Was there ever a time, Charlie, when you thought about doing something other than being around the racetrack?
Well, in college and everything like that, I was studying art history. I actually dropped out of college to start working with the horses just because I knew I didn't want to live my life in an office or a library or anything like that. And school was always easy for me. I always did well, always tested well, even on days I didn't feel like studying. But as difficult as this job is physically, it also is difficult and challenging mentally. So I kind of use my education to help me out in this industry. And I don't know, I never really saw myself in this. I never saw myself in anything. I kind of just went through a fog my entire life until I started doing this. And I was like, wow, I don't know what I want to do with horses, but I know I'm going to work with horses.
Where'd you go to college?
And I haven't left them since. I started with College of St. Elizabeth, and they didn't have an art history major. So after 2 years, I actually transferred to Montclair State.
Are you still interested in art?
I still go to museums. I actually took my first day off in 2 years a couple months ago and went to the Guggenheim for the first time ever. I love Frank Lloyd Wright because he's much like me, where he just always did whatever he wanted.
Sure.
So being in the Guggenheim was very nice, especially because I could see how difficult it was for the curators to hang paintings on a curved wall. But that's one of the reasons why Frank Lloyd Wright became so famous, because he had such a beautiful mind and he utilized it and didn't listen to what anyone else told him to do. He's like, no, this is how I want to view things, how I want to architect, and that's what I'm going to do.
What do you think you might be doing if you weren't training horses right now?
Probably managing a McDonald's. Because that's what I was doing as my job. I was a manager, just a regular manager. I'd probably be this so much time later, a store manager by now, with nice benefits, two paid vacations a year, and, you know, all that. And as easy as McDonald's was for me, I just hated it. It wasn't, there was no love in it. And I never wanted to get up and go. And as tired as I am in the morning, I always want to show up for the horses.
Yeah, that's a great point, because, you know, you talk about, okay, the two paid vacations a year. You don't get a vacation now, Charlie. This is a 24/7, 365-day-a-week profession that you've chosen.
And my paid vacation is I pay someone else to give me a vacation.
Right, correct. Totally different ball game now.
Yeah.
You know, we've had trainers on this show who have given up six-figure jobs, just walked away and said, I'm going to go get up every morning at 4 a.m. and I'm going to go train horses 365 days a year. What is it that makes somebody want to make these moves?
I don't get up at 4 a.m. Everyone actually laughs at me because I roll in about between 6 and 7.
Oh, perfect.
And they're like, Charlie, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, I only have two horses and I have a freelance rider that can only come late anyway. Why am I getting here early? So that the best part about being my own boss now is being able to wake up late, because when I was grooming and all that, yeah, it was the 4 a.m. wake ups, and that's grueling. It's very the groom's job is most likely the hardest job on the backside.
Yeah.
Yep.
How important is it to have a good groom working with you and good people around your barn?
It's one of the most important things. If you don't have good help, then you're shot, because you don't only just need someone who cares about the horses. You need someone who knows what they're looking at, who can at least, even if they don't understand what the horse is trying to communicate, they'll communicate with the trainer, hey, I'm seeing the horse do this. Or, you know, they're standing like that. You need a good help that's going to communicate. You need good help that's going to have heart. And if you don't have good help, because even me, I don't technically have hired help, but I have a lot of horsemen that care about me. So they will throw in opinions or notice things that I didn't notice with my horses. And we all actually wind up helping each other back here.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Yeah.
It's a fraternity. It's a sorority. It is the camaraderie, even though all trainers are competing against each other, the camaraderie and the fact that everybody is, for the most part, willing to help you when you're just getting started. And I've heard that a lot on this program over the years. That's something that's so unique to thoroughbred racing in a lot of ways, isn't it?
It really is, because, you know, when I'm in that paddock, I'm going against people that I've either worked for, like beating Georgia Navarro was a huge deal just because just last year I was working for him. And so, like, a part of me was really happy, but a part of me, like, felt bad, like, sorry. But at the same time, he congratulated me. He said, you know, I'm proud of you. And he's like, and he said, he's like, I wasn't the only trainer in that race anyway. It's not like you only beat me. So,
always nice when the student
is very important.
Yeah, it's always nice when the student can beat the teacher, though, right?
I guess so. Yes.
Charlie,
because that day he reminded me of a horse that Georgie has named Flowers for Lisa, and that horse also loves the mud and will go gate to wire in any kind of company.
Yeah, nice horse, Flowers for Lisa.
Yeah, very nice horse.
Talking with Charlie Demodio here on HRN, Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton, just getting started with her training career. But as you can tell, she has a passion for the sport. And Charlie, it sounds to me like you approach this, and correct me if I'm wrong, with a little bit of a chip on your shoulder because of some of the people that have told you, you can't do this. And they've doubted you along the way. And now you're proving everybody wrong.
I'm pretty sure I was born with a chip on my shoulder. I have been that way since, I think, before I even started talking. Like, even my my adoptive mother would tell me that when I first started walking, I didn't start walking until I was 14 months old, but I was full-blown walking. She said, oh, you just stood up one day and started walking. And I think even before I was consciously aware of it, I refused to let people help me and just always tried to build my strength on my own. But I am glad that Zoppy taught me to let people help me, because I definitely would not have won without help from the backside.
All right, let's go back to that. You mentioned Zoppy and Joseph Zoppy, your former boss, who ended up being the reason that you got into training full time. Joe passed away at the age of 74 on July 2nd. It was less than 2 months after you took over training the horses that were in his care. Take me back through the story and how this all came about for you.
The story actually starts last year. Because last year I would see him a lot, and I never stopped talking to him after I stopped working for him. We always remained close. You know, we stopped by the barn and always told him, you got to come back and work for me, you got to come back and work for me. And, you know, I was trying to move up the ranks in Georgie's barn. So I was like, no, Joe, I'm like, what's going on? And he's just like, oh, he's blaming everything on the groom. And then the groom left him, and when the meet was coming to a close, I was just feeling homesick, and everything was telling me to stay in Jersey, so I stayed in Jersey for Joe. But it wasn't Joe anymore. It was so strange. It was like every once in a while it was him, but then he would disappear for a while, wasn't really checking up on the horses that much. So they really fell under my care in the winter time, and I would only hear from him like every 2 weeks when he would show up with money. And I'm like, that's not like Joe either. You'd always pay on time. And I was even actually picking up extra work at a farm around the corner. Rory Houston was kind enough to let me come over and do stalls a couple of days a week just so I can get some extra cash in my pocket. And I told him, I was like, I don't know what's going on with Joe, but I can't abandon the horses. So they are still going to remain priority. And he said, that's fine. Then it was in March. It was March 22nd. All of a sudden, Joe's calling me at, like, 4 a.m. I'm like, this is really weird. And it's a police officer. And he said, you know, Joe drove into a field in Pemberton. He's not very lucid. Seems like he might have dementia. And I said, you know what? That's something I've been suspecting lately based on his behavior. And they asked me to go pick him up because they couldn't get a hold of anyone else. And I didn't know any of his family because Joe always referred to himself as the black sheep.
Mm-hmm.
So I go and I pick him up and I bring him home, and the house is a wreck. There's no food. There's rotten milk in the fridge. There's mold growing in the sink, a huge hole in the wall. And he had been complaining about falling over, I just didn't realize it was that bad, that he was falling over and making a huge hole in the wall. He fell into one of the tables and broke it in half. And I'm looking around like this. I was like, I can't leave this man here. I was like, there's something wrong. And if he's left alone here, he's going to die alone here. So I actually was lucky enough to get in, because he was in and out with information, in and out with remembering things. And I got a hold of his primary, Dr. Rioli, and we went over to him right away. Because when I got a hold of Rioli, they said, oh, he was supposed to be here 5 weeks ago and never showed, and we never heard from him. So if we're worried about him, yes, please bring him in. And we're sitting there in the office with Dr. Rioli, and Rioli looks at me and says, this isn't Joe. I said, I know. And we're having this conversation in front of Joe, and Joe doesn't even realize we're having a conversation about him in front of him.
Wow.
And then I spent 8 hours in the ER trying to convince them that I had a man in front of me that didn't just have dementia. There was something more wrong than that. Because every time a new face would come in, he was all of a sudden lucid again. He was all of a sudden, like, sharp, carrying on regular conversation, remembering important information. So they're like, you're nuts. And I'm like, I'm not nuts. He's actually something wrong. It wasn't until around 10 o'clock that night, a doctor did like a special cognitive test with his hands. And she was like, you know what? Yeah, he needs an MRI. And once the staff got to see his ups and downs, it's like a roller coaster ride, because he kept even trying to get up to leave. And I'm like, Joe, where are you going? He's like, we're going home. You're here to pick me up. I'm like, no, I'm not, Joe. Sit down. And there was even one point where I got him back for a few minutes. I'm like, why do I keep thinking I'm leaving? I was like, I don't know, Joe. He's like, there's something wrong with me. I was like, I know, Joe. That's why we're here. We're going to figure out what's wrong. And after a couple of days of testing, they did a special type of CAT scan that told them he had the prion disease or the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or mad cow disease, however you want to call it. But either way, once we knew, we just knew he was knocking at best door. And he was placed in a nursing home that would be able to take care of him with his deteriorating disease. I got maybe a few more days, like, out of my visits over the course of the time. The last time I really spoke to Joe was like the end of April, even though he didn't pass away until July. And I actually went all of May not visiting him because I knew it wasn't him anymore. And it killed me to go see him and him not be there. And then after that, those 4 weeks, I just felt so guilty. And I was like, I have to at least spend time with him. And I still went once a week. And his cousin even called me right before he passed. He said, you know, he's finally ready to say goodbye. And I went and saw him the evening before he passed away and said goodbye. And I was just telling him, like, Joe, just let go. Your body is done now. Like, just finally let go and rest. And the following morning is when he passed away.
Emotional stuff from our special guest here on Trainer Talk tonight. She is trainer Charlie DiModio and a longtime assistant to Joseph Zoppi, who trained 101 winners. He was very well known as being a champion of the horsemen in New Jersey, longtime member of the board of directors for the New Jersey Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association, and for many years administered kind of a hands-on testing for aspiring New Jersey horsemen. Joe Zoppi, again, passed away July 2nd of this year. And we're going to continue this conversation with Charlie DiModio right after this short commercial break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the impact that Joe had on her career and is having now as she moves forward with some of the horses that were in Joe's care before he passed away. That's all next. Stay with me. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Nominations are now open to the Fasig Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. The sale annually produces the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world, and in 2018 sold 22 horses for $1 million or higher. Held the Monday after the Breeders' Cup, this one-night sale offers leading racing and broodmare prospects, proven producers, and selected yearlings in the most electric atmosphere you will find at any thoroughbred auction. Nominate your best today, the Fasig Tipton November Sale, where stars shine brightest.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves No Doubt today. she won the FIPS in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
In the recent Blood Horse Market Watch study of leading consigners with more than 100 yearlings offered from 2014 to 2016, Millridge Sales ranked highest among percentage of stakes horses and winners of $100,000 or more. Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 34 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners. Their consignment at this year's Keeneland September sale includes yearlings from deep families by leading stallions such as Candy Ride, Curlin, Empire Maker, Ghost Sapper, More Than Ready, Quality Road, and Uncle Mo. Millridge, raising and selling racehorses. I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, exactly how do the Flair strips work?
Mike, remember that a horse only breathes through its nose when it's running. About 50% of the resistance to getting the oxygen through the nose and into the lungs is at the nasal passages. They're the narrowest part of the upper airway, and that's where Flair strips work. The strips are proven to help prevent the nasal passages from collapsing, so horses breathe easier and get the oxygen they need more efficiently.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios, visiting with brand new trainer Charlie Demodio, who is now out on her own. If you missed any portion of the first half of the show and our story of her first winner, which came on September 2nd at Monmouth Park, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. They're available for you each and every week, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And, of course, you can follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter and on Instagram, and Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. Well, Charlie ended the first half of the program with that emotional story of her former boss, trainer Joseph Zappi, who, as I mentioned, trained 101 winners in a career that spanned more than a few decades. And he had the reputation of being somebody who would help young trainers who were coming up, and he did that with Charlie. Charlie, spend some time talking about the impact that Joe had on your life personally and on your career.
I will always be grateful to Joe, because, like, as I mentioned earlier, my father asked him to make my life miserable. But I think Joe saw, like, a part of himself in me, just the passion, the love. And he also liked that things always made sense to me. He'd say something like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. He didn't have to explain a lot. And I think that's why he always had this internal struggle where he was trying to be loyal to my father, but then he's like, oh, wait, no, there's actually potential here, and he didn't want to stomp out the potential.
Yeah.
And he, like you said, he's done that for a lot of horsemen. And I guess the biggest impact is he just showed me the sportsmanship of it, And I'm trying to follow in his footsteps in that way, where if someone wants to learn, I will give them that shot. I'll try and teach them if they want to learn. If they want to move on, then move on. If they want to stick around, then I'll help them stick around. Because, like I said, a lot of people told me I couldn't do this. And even Joe told me I couldn't do it. He's like, oh, you're a woman, you're not going to be able to handle the horses, blah, blah, blah.
Really?
And, yeah. And I just, because he saw so many women that were successful, but he also saw so many women that did get hurt and lose their heart. And it was a great challenge, too, because that's where the chip in the shoulder came in handy. And I was just like, no, I'm going to prove you wrong. And one of our last conversations together, like I said, I had one final good conversation with him before I never got to really speak to him again. And I remember he was rubbing his eyes because the lights were bothering him, and he's trying to collect his thoughts. And he's telling me, like, it's not that I don't trust you. It's just that I'm scared. And he was scared the type of life that I would lead in this industry, because it can go downhill for so many people, or so many people can get hurt and end up crippled or dead. And I think he was just more scared for me. And that's why sometimes he would tell me I couldn't do it, because he just didn't want to be responsible for me being hurt in any way.
What do you think Joe would have said if he was there to see you saddle Candy Cane Lane to that victory on September 2nd?
I think he would have just shook his head and like, this broad really thinks she can do it. Okay, let's see if she can do it. And he would have stuck the cigar back in his mouth, and he would have sat back and watched, and he would have then been screaming just as much as I was. And I was screaming just like Joe. I was like, you dirty rat, you better stay up there. I think he would have been proud. And Joe is definitely the type of person, which is why he challenged me the way he did, where I had to prove to him I could do it. And he would have been proud of me for proving it to him instead of just listening and giving up.
Well, you know, this is very much a male-dominated profession, the profession of training racehorses. And there have been several female trainers that have come on this program over the years that have been ultra-successful. And I've always said, if you can train horses, it doesn't matter what your gender is. But let me ask you this, Charlie. Is it more challenging for a young lady like yourself getting started in the business than it would be for, say, a young man in that same position?
Yes.
It is.
Especially because I know a young man who he walked up to a trainer like just at the grandstand and was like, I want to be a trainer. How do I do that? And the trainer was like, oh, show up in the morning, we'll start teaching you. And the kid's not training yet, but he's going through it without the challenge of that trainer telling him, no, you can't do this. So instead, he's being groomed. He's being raised to train instead of being challenged to give up on it because it's out of his league.
Huh. You know, there's several female jockeys that we've interviewed over the years, and they will tell me that in some ways they feel that because they're a female, they have a little bit of an advantage because of the way that they can get the horse to relate to them. Is there something to be said for that?
That is definitely said about a lot of females, because a lot of females have a lot more patience with the horses. And they would rather communicate with the horse than fight with the horse. And that's why I even tell people about Candy Cane, like any new rider that's getting on them, I said, don't try and fight with them. I'm like, you're just going to piss them off. So I'm like, don't even bother, because you're going to have a worse time riding this horse than fighting them than being relaxed with them.
Yep.
And yeah, a lot of females know how to relax and just communicate with the horse. And they that's where they are more successful, yes. And they will continue to dominate, or as I say, we will continue to dominate and increase our numbers in the racing industry because of the way we can communicate with horses. And that is something that has been shown through the ages as the difference between males and females, that we have a little more understanding in our hearts.
Who are some of the other trainers that you tend to watch closely or maybe even look up to when you hang out around the barns at Monmouth Park?
I try not to put anyone on a pedestal. I think every single trainer I can learn what to do and what not to do from. Everyone has their own tricks. Everyone has their own ways of doing things. I especially like the ones that would prefer more to do different things with each horse. The ones that will want to do the same thing with every horse, every day, all the horses are on the same program, those are the ones I kind of ignore the most, because I'm like, oh, okay, you're treating them like a machine, whereas like each horse is an individual. They're each an individual athlete who they all like to run certain ways. That's why you have your sprinters and your distance horses. That's why you have your speed horses or your closers. You know, they're are all different, and they all need to train differently. So I try and pay attention to the ones that I know are successful based on their heart. Other than that, I really don't have a favorite. They're all people at the end of the day.
Yep.
Yeah.
talking with trainer Charlie DiModio, just getting started with that training career. She's my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, we're going to send Charlie a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll send those out to Charlie after this program here this afternoon. Charlie, after you left working with Joe Zoppi, you went and spent some time with Skip Einhorn. You mentioned Shea Stewart and six-time leading trainer Jorge Navarro. Tell me about working with somebody like Jorge Navarro. How much different was that than your experience with Joe Zoppi?
Well, obviously a lot more horses.
Mm-hmm.
Georgie, he just had different goals than Zoppi. So that's where you also have to look at it, too. Like, Zoppi, if he really wanted to be like Navarro, he could have been. But those weren't his goals. Like, Navarro, he likes the numbers. He likes even challenging himself and beating his own numbers. And I don't know. That was something almost to look up to in a way. I don't ever want to have an outfit like Georgie. It's just too much for me. And I can see how it is. It's personally too much for me. But it's good to look up to a man like that who built himself up, who actually even came from another country. I mean, he's originally from Panama. And he followed the American dream. And now he has this great name for himself, and that is something to look up forward to for myself as well. Like, I hope one day people know my name like they know his. Because this is one of the last industries where you can start at the bottom being nobody and follow the American dream as we're taught as children and work yourself up. And you have to motivate yourself. You have to want it. And Georgie really taught me that. He taught me to want it. And other than that, I loved working for him. The big outfit was really nice because it was a family. They got me through a lot of tough times, whereas if I was in a small outfit at that time, like still with Joe would have helped me out, but Joe was just, you know, a single unit family, whereas Navarro's barn is just a nice giant family where everyone loves each other, and we still fight and grapple like family, too. But we still watch out for each other's horses, even. You know, it's not just like, oh, well, I groom these five and that's it. No, you know, you see someone else needs help with their horse and they need help. And that was a really nice experience being in a family, because everyone calls his outfit a factory. And it's just, it's not. It's just, there's a lot of horses, but it's a giant family and everyone's just trying to win and they want to win, but they're taking care of the horses so they can win.
Yeah, and you were working with George Navarro when you got the call that Joe Zoppi wasn't doing well and that they were looking for somebody to take over his horses, right?
See, that's what bothered me a little bit about that article. That's not quite how it happened. There was
okay. No
real call.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just me figuring out on my own after knowing Zoppi for so many years that there was something wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, but it was Joe who had asked me to stay for him, and I was just like, you know what, I will. Like, I could feel and hear the desperation. I knew I had to stay in New Jersey for him. I didn't know why, but I knew I had to stay. And I walked away. Well, at the time, I thought I was walking away from big opportunities, and I didn't realize I was actually walking forward into an opportunity.
Yep.
It just turned out that way.
Well, take me back to the day that you saddled your very first starter. I think it was, what, May 18th at Monmouth with a horse named Cotton Time. Is that right?
Cotton Time, yes. That fickle little, well, now mare. I always still called her the filly because she was tiny. She was funny and so much potential and so much talent and definitely had the speed. But no desire to actually compete. And she's officially retired now. I found a riding home for her, and a young girl named Willie Rosetta has her. And she's going to restart her and hopefully find her way into a show ring, which I think she would do very well, especially because she's so pretty. and very willing to jump. She just, she had no real heart in running. Like, she liked to exercise. She'd like to go gallop. She'd like to, especially like to take a hold of the bit and go. But in a race, she was just like, whatever. She didn't care. She didn't care about the other horses. And that's something big I think some people need to recognize, too, in this industry, is when to give up on a horse. And that's why I gave up on her, because otherwise you risk ruining them. And for what? I could have maybe started her 20 more times and finally broke her maiden and said, hey, look, I finally broke her maiden. But for what? It was really for nothing. And it certainly wouldn't have been for the horse. It would have been for myself. And I just wasn't going to do that to her because she was a real sweetheart.
Yeah. What was that like walking into the paddock that day with the first starter that you're going to saddle in your own name? What was that like?
I actually didn't saddle. Jim Popovich saddled for me that day.
Okay.
He was helping me and teaching me, and I was still schooling and learning and just wasn't very comfortable and ready yet and was a total nervous Nelly. And he actually saddled her for me, and then after that, I started saddling.
All right. So what was the first horse that you actually saddled?
It was actually caught in time with her second start with me.
Okay.
And she was so good in the paddock, and I was so nervous. And everyone, like I said, this is a family here, and I've been here over 10 years now. So,
well, the good thing is that at least Monmouth
area knew me. So they were like, we were watching, you know, my good friend Grimek Pittman. I've known him for so many years. He used to be a valet. And he told me afterwards, he said, don't worry, we were all watching, paying attention. If you needed help, we were there, ready to help you. And so far, everything's been smooth. Her and even Candy Cane's been good in the paddock as well. And I didn't have to really worry about anything because you can see how dangerous saddling in the paddock can get. But that was a nice relief knowing that I was amongst family.
Well, the best part about the Monmouth paddock, Charlie, is that if you do get really nervous, they have the bar just steps away. So you can just hit the bar right in the paddock.
The bar?
Yeah, in Mont, do they still have the bar?
Oh, the bar. Oh, the regular bar. Yeah, don't worry. I have that too. The finish line bar.
Right.
For once, alcohol is not on my mind. That's a good sign,
actually. that's a good, yeah, right. You're moving in the right direction, Charlie.
Yes. But yes, that bar is right there. I actually know the bartenders very well, and they're good girls. And they know I like to drink cranberry and vodka. And so anytime I come up, they're like, do you want a Charlie today? I'm like, yes, please. Can I have a Charlie?
Perfect.
Yeah. But no, fortunately, I haven't really needed that. It's usually when I'm watching the races when I want my drink because I'm just like shaking the whole time. Because no matter knowing that I'm sending out a sound horse, I'm always so worried about a breakdown. And, like, that's always the scariest thing on my mind. Like, what if something happened?
Yeah,
and actually, my first start with Candy Cane, he faded in the stretch. Not the stretch, sorry. He faded in the back stretch. And I'm like, why is he fading? What happened? I'm like, he's fit enough. And he comes back, and he's actually sliced up on the hind tendon and the ankle. And luckily, it was all superficial, but it was enough to make him say, no, I'm not running at this race anymore. He was like, ouch, that hurts. And I went and watched the replay, and I saw a horse, you know, it rushed up on him, and it wasn't even the jockey's fault because the jockey did his best to collect the horse and get off of Candy Cane's heels, which thank God the jockey did take control of the horse because it could have turned into an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And that is always my biggest fear is, like, what if something happens? All it takes is even just a bad step, and a horse can go down. And that's, every time I send one out, I'm just like, please just come back safe. You can come back dead last, but come back safe.
Yeah.
And that's why I was so happy with Candy Cane that day. Like, okay, you know, he came back, he's got a cut, but he protected himself. He decided, no, I can't run out the race with this. And we took care of it. It wasn't much to take care of, thank goodness. And he came back and ran that second. And I was very proud of him with that even. That day felt like a victory because that was my first second. And after him fading with my first start with him, and then coming back and running that second, and I was just so happy. And I was really happy that no one sliced him up that day.
Yeah, that's always a plus. Talking with trainer Charlie DiModio here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Charlie, earlier when you talked about being around Georgie Navarro's operation, you said that, you know, that big of an operation really wasn't for you. You don't want to go that direction. So what's, you said you have two horses in training now. What's the optimal number that you would like to have?
For now, especially, keep things small. Because as we discussed earlier, it's hard to find good help. So until I am confident that I have the help I can count on to groom the way I like to groom and even have eyes the way I like to have eyes on the horses, I don't want big numbers because I can't do it all on my own. Right now I am doing it on my own with some help here and there. I have a good friend, Lance. He's an old horseman. He's trained before as well. It wasn't the life for him. He didn't care, but he's an excellent horseman. And he's one of the second pairs of eyes that I have here that I wouldn't be successful without. He doesn't feel like grooming, so I'm not getting more horses. But yeah, I mean, optimal max 10, but if I just keep doing it on my own, between 3 and 5, just hopefully over time improve the stock, basically. Like right now, Candy Cane is a very nice horse. My other horse has the potential of being a nice horse. We'll see how he goes. He breathes very well today. I was happy with his breeze. He breathes a half and 50. And
what's his name?
Outbreak. I'm sorry?
What's his name?
That's Victory Tour.
Okay.
Yeah, he is... He ran a second for Joe, but a fourth and a second for Joe last year. And then when he came to the farm, his behavior, he was like a nutcase. And I'm like, what is wrong? I gave him time off. I'm like, there's something wrong with you, so you're getting time off. So I only started him back in the spring with the training. So I haven't had a start yet with him. And it'll be like with Candy, when he's ready and he says he's ready is when he'll start. Other than that, I'm not going to push him because that is something Joe had said about him. Because when I was trying to get info out of Joe's ailing mind, he started talking about Sammy's trip, which was another, coincidentally, chestnut he used to have. And he said, I pushed Sammy. And he's like, and I shouldn't have pushed Sammy. He's like, I don't want to push Victory. And that's why I'm not pushing this horse.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last things Joe told me was to don't push him. So I said, okay, when the horse is ready is when the horse is ready.
You know, there's two things, Charlie, listening to you talk throughout much of this program that kind of stick out to me. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like if I were to describe your approach to training horses, the one word that comes to mind is patience. And the other thing that comes to mind is put the horse first. Is that accurate?
Yeah definitely. It's an argument I have had with fellow grooms and hot walkers over the years, because even if they want to only walk a horse a short amount of time rather than a long amount of time, or they want to do this instead of that because it makes it easier in their life, even though they should be doing it for the horse, it's always like, they're the reason why we're here. They're the reason why there's a roof over my head. There's a reason why there's food in my belly. They're the reason why every single one of us has a job. So if you don't put them first and don't take care of them, how are you going to even make money off of them? How are you going to get that food in your belly? They have to come first. If I'm going to be successful, it has to be about the horses, not about me. Because if I don't make it about them, what do they care about me?
Yeah. Yeah, you take care of them, they'll take care of you.
Exactly.
Charlie, only about, less than 5 minutes left before we have to wrap things up here. It's been an hour that has just flown by, been an enjoyable visit. I'll ask you this question. We talked earlier about your love of art, and I often like to end the show by asking trainers what else they enjoy outside of horse racing. That's certainly one thing. if you do get a chance to follow something else or to do something else outside of racing, what's Charlie DiModio going to do?
Well, I always joke that one day I'm going to charge really rich people to fix their badly behaved horses.
There you go.
I say I'm going to be a horse therapist one day. And or maybe even write books on it or something like that. Go back to school and for, you know, behavioral, like psychology. They call it behavioral psychology of non-human animals is the actual official way of saying it.
Okay.
But always, if it's not training, it's always going to be something to do with horses or animals in general. I fostered dogs before. Me and my ex did 14 dogs together. We fostered over the course of a couple years. And I think that's going to be my go-to, especially if one of these horses ever does finally cripple me. I'll just have to settle with talking about their behaviors and how you can fix their behaviors, and especially proving to people how thoroughbreds really aren't as crazy as everyone thinks they are.
Yeah, well, you touched on it earlier. If you're willing to listen to them and you pick up on some of the tells before they start becoming a really bad actor, it can save you a lot of trouble up the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to tell when they're faking it. They're smart. They'll go lame on you, and there's nothing wrong with them.
Do you spend much time involving social media in your operation? Are you on, you know, Twitter and Instagram and things like that? Does that tie into what you're doing as a horse trainer?
A couple years ago, I started following the OTT B-Connect on Facebook, and I follow other couple of horse pages, and actually a lot of tips and a lot of insight has come through other people's experiences that they now are expressing through the internet. And, you know, a lot of this industry is about networking and talking, because anything and everything can happen with a horse. And there's been, I forget what it was. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember Joe making a comment like, in 30 years, I've never seen anything like this. But he, you know, you talk around, you eventually will find someone who's seen something like that you're dealing with. And they figured out how to take care of it, and then they share that information with you, hopefully, and then you pass the buck, because that's what you should do. If someone asks, for help, you got help, so you should help that person ask them as well. Yeah. And that's when it also comes down to the horses, too. It's not about, oh, well, I'm not going to help you because I don't like you. No, help that person because you're actually helping the horse with sharing that information.
A lot of
my aid has come through other people's experiences that they've expressed online, and I'm grateful to the internet for that as well.
Well, she is trainer Charlie DiModio, and as you heard here tonight, just getting started with that training career, she is as passionate about the sport as any trainer that we've had on the program. And Charlie, can't thank you enough for the visit here tonight. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We could spend another hour, but we'll have to do part two maybe after you win the Kentucky Derby up the road.
That would be fantastic. We'll see if that's ever a goal. Right now, it's just handling these two and see what we can do.
Thanks, Charlie. Appreciate the visit here tonight, and all the best moving forward.
And thank you so much. And I appreciate that nasal strip that's coming, because I actually want one for Victory Tour. So you're saving me a few bucks. Thank you.
There you go. We'll get it out to you. Charlie DiModio, ladies and gentlemen, our special guest here on Trainer Talk tonight. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast. You can listen at your leisure, horseracingradio.net. Well, for my producer, Lee Delapina, and our Jimmy Johns of Lexington Studios, for our special guest, Charlie DiModio, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.